This is the Kick-Ass Live podcast with David Wood and Carl Studner.
Thanks for listening to the Kick-Ass Life with David Wood. Stay connected on Facebook / the Kick-Ass Life, on Twitter at the Kick-Ass Life, and of course at thekickasslife.com.
Jambo, fellow adventurers, this is Mike Dooley, and you are listening to David Wood on the Kick-Ass Life Show.
Can you believe it? These weeks go by fast, and it's so much fun, so much fun. Wow, just had a great, great chat coming up with just this guy, man. He's a legend in his field, and I can't wait to tell you, but I'm going to keep you in suspense. Yeah, you already know anyway, because you've looked at the podcast title, so you know who it is. You may not know him, though. He's not one of those famous people that everyone knows. But those of us that know him, he really is a legend in what he does, and he has graced the homes and lives of truly the rich and famous, and really been around some of the most interesting people on earth. So, yeah, looking forward to it. It's going to be a great, great chat. And, you know, him and I have got a good friendship developing. I would say developing because, you know, I come from Europe. And so friends in North America, I find quite often people, they meet you for an afternoon and they use the word friendship. And then 10 minutes later, they can't remember your name. And I always find that friendship for me is something that takes some time. And not a long time with me, because I've got to a point right now where I really trust so fully and I'm so open with people that, you know, friendship's an easy thing for me to do. But truly about friendship for me is you know, when you go through those peaks and valleys, I always say, I joke that I've had fights with all of my closest friends, you know, and I'm always willing to tell them the truth and open to telling me the truth. In fact, it's really funny. You know, the first podcast I did was a solo. And, you know, everyone's telling me, oh, it's great, you know, but I got all this new equipment around me and I'm you know, and I'm kind of like learning how to do this. Technically, I'm not that savvy, or I wasn't. I'm getting better and better, obviously. And so, you know, distracted, I wasn't really myself. And it took one of my closest friends listening to it a couple of days ago, said, hey, Dave, that's not you. He said, I heard those stories you sound. This is my friend Mike, you know, and I mentioned this before. So, you know, it's that's a friend. Friend who's going to come and tell you the truth, and it's not always pretty. You got to suck it up, and I send him some love and say thank you for that. So what I want to talk about today, well, and you know, one of the things I'm working on as well, I noticed listening to myself, which is hard to do sometimes, I know, but I was listening to the Marcy Shmioff interview, because I, you know, I really want to learn from her. Laying in the hot tub with Jen, and we're just listening to this this interview and this conversation. It's really an interview, a conversation. And I notice I say, you know. So if it drives you nuts, don't worry. I'm working on it. My buddy Mike says, hey, just put a big sign up on your podcast screen and with the word, you know, crossed out. So anyway, I'm working on it. You may be sitting there going, he says, you know, a lot. And it's really funny with Marcy. I notice that she does it as well. But guess what? We're just old people. We got our little quirks. So I thought I'd share a story today, you know. I did it. There you go. You know. It's just in there. I got to wheedle that thing out because it drives me nuts when I listen to myself. I thought I'd share a story about flying today, because I'm a great believer that, you know, I'm going to catch myself. I'm a great believer that if I put my mind to anything and I do it in an intense format, that I can learn something, right? And I had this kid at school, Jonathan, who was this great artist. And he was an artist who drew bombers from like the Lancaster bombers and Messerschmitts and all these different planes from the World War. And he was brilliant. He had all these fancy pens and had just mesmerized by his work. And it sort of started in me this love of Lancasters, that because he drew them so beautifully. And I don't know where that came from. But years and years and years later, and this would be about 10 years ago from today, I was driving through southern Alberta, and there's a small town, I can't even remember the name of it, Alberta in Canada. So you got Calgary, and you go south of Calgary through High River, and it's south of there somewhere. Driving through one day, and there's this big Lancaster Bomber Museum. And the reason why there's these Lancaster bombers out in the middle of nowhere is because the farmers after the war would drag these Lancaster bombers over to the farms and use them as spare parts. And that's what they did. So these Lancaster bombers found themselves in these small towns as spare parts. But this museum, this Lancaster had been kind of restored and the museum's there. And I had this kind of, oh, moment. So I went over and I knock on the door because it's locked and the curator's in there sweeping up just under the Lancaster bomber. And I said, hey, I'm just driving through. Any chance I could pop in? He said, yeah, come in. So he wandered off and did his thing, and I climbed up into this Lancaster bomber, and I'm sitting there in the cockpit, and I'm reading. There's little signs everywhere talking about the different positions in the plane and where the plane had been, you know, and this plane had been in battle, and you could tell. And the life expectancy of a tail gunner in battle was 4 minutes or 6 minutes. It was around there. It was a few minutes that the life expectancy of a tail gunner in battle. And as I'm reading this, and I'm overwhelmed, and tears started to come down my face. And I suddenly had this feeling that I should get my pilot's license. So about 2 months later, I take a month off of work. I have 30 days, and I'm going to do my pilot's license. Now, I mean, I've told you before, you know, I left school at 15, could hardly read and write, you know, never passed an exam, didn't learn how to study. And this concept of doing the ground school portion, let alone the flying portion, you got to do the ground school portion to the same level that you do the flying portion, like the same as a commercial pilot, you know. And so I start off, and a buddy of mine shows up, and we go out and have a few beers, get up late the next morning, and my instructor, this young kid, he was like 19 or 20, Darren, he says, Dave, he says, if you're going to do this, you can't do it like this. You've got to really focus. So that's what I did. You know, I decided to chuck my buddy out, and I started focusing. I did two flights a day. Every day, and I did the ground school portion, which was incredibly hard. And Darren was a saint because he would start really simplifying everything so it sounded, you know, and I could learn it. He didn't use technical terms, and he went through it with me. And about halfway through, the chief flying instructor came over and said, "Hey, Dave, you know, I just want to let you know, you can't do this in 30 days. It's not going to happen." And so there was a buzz in the place. I'm showing up sometimes three flights a day, but definitely two flights a day. You know, and after, imagine this, from never flying to my first solo was just a few days because I'm doing two flights a day. And within less than a week, I'm doing my first cross country on my own. And I had to fly I was doing it in the municipal airport in Edmonton in Canada. And we flew over to a little airport called Villeneuve, which is a few miles away. So through the city, because the municipal airport's right downtown. And I take a flight out, and you know, in the Cessna on my own, do my first sort of touch and go at another airport and come back before my cross country, which was the next day, which I was flying for a couple of hours. And here I am thinking, I've only been doing this for a week. And here I am flying over the city of Edmonton in this Cessna 172. And I remember when I landed, I bombed the landing, and I bounced up. It felt like 100 feet. It probably was more like 50. But I bounced this plane, and I'm like, "G'day, mate. This is Kangaroo Airline bouncing in," you know. And I'm joking on there, but anyway, and I get this wheel shutter. So the wheel shutter is so bad, I don't know what to do. I had no idea how to fix it. All you have to do is pull back on the control. But I went to the tower and I asked the guy to come down and help me out. Anyway, he was really angry. By the time I got back to the airport, I got a reprimand for joking on the airways, which apparently you're not allowed to do. Anyway, big story was, though, when it came to the 28th day, I'm leaving 2 days later to go to South Africa. And the 28th day, I've done my ground school, which I passed. And now I'm doing the flying portion. And the chief instructor, the one that told me that I wasn't going to do it, he's there. And he realizes how hard I worked. And they've written an article about me in the magazine. It's thinking, now there's a lot of pressure. But the weather is terrible. There's a low ceiling, and we have to get up to 5,000 feet to do the upper air work. And the ceiling's up about, you know, 2,500-3,000 feet. So I can't get up there. So this guy, instead of spending an hour on the ground with me doing all of the, you know, questions and walking around the plane, we spend 3 or 4 hours. And he says, in the end, he says, Dave, I'm sorry, we can't do it. And so I'm disappointed. I'm flying out there 2 days later, and I don't have another booking for an exam. And so as he walks that way, I'm dejected. And suddenly he comes running back in and he says, Dave, get in the plane. And we walk outside. And again, these sound like crazy stories, but there's a kind of a circle in the sky. It looks like there's this opening. Whoa, here we go. Anyway, so he says, let's go up there and do the upper air work. And we'll come down lower and do the rest of your flying portion. So we shoot up through this circle. I do my stalls and my spins. I come back down and we go to and we do everything else. Anyway, I end up passing. And it was within 28 days. So this is a big deal. And this sets up the call today because my guest is this incredible man who walks his talk. And we've had so much fun together in Hawaii. We were in Hawaii together, in New Orleans together. And so we've had some adventures together. But he truly is a craftsman. He's one of the world's great photographers, photographing the Dalai Lama, Paul McCartney. I mean, you name it. This guy's the who's who. But really, it's his idea, his concepts around the camera, and this idea that within each of us is this perfect light that we can let shine. And he captures that, not just with people, but with animals and with nature. He captures it all. So, yeah, I want to invite you into this wonderful conversation, which I know is going to be off the charts, because I watch this guy when no one else is watching, and I've seen him in the small moments, and he walks his talk, and what he's got to share, I know is going to have a huge impact on my life. So, Carl, I'm just so excited about having you here. Welcome to the Kick-Ass Life podcast. And it's just so great. So I was thinking about the last time that we were together in Hawaii having fun. And but it's so great that you're on the call.
Thank you, David. I love being here, and I'm so glad that you offered this to me.
Well, you know, I part of the offering is to really, you know, when I think about Kick-Ass, what that means to me, and to bring people people I want to talk to that really exemplify in their lives by how they walk through life, you know, what that means, you know, to have a kick-ass life, and I really feel that about you, and I've told you that you know, truly you have this the presence that you have. And the work you chose, and that's really where I want to start. I'm fascinated. I've heard this story once, the first time we met, and I was mesmerized by the story of a young boy who decides on a path. I know that you know, Les Brown talks about the two most important days in a person's life is the day they're born and the day they discover why. And you discovered why early on. And I wonder if you can share that story again for me.
Sure, I'd love to, David. So when I was 14 years old, Paul McCartney's first solo album was coming out, and I loved the Beatles. So I rushed to the record store, bought the album, brought it home, ripped open the cellophane, opened it, and immediately went for the pictures, because already at that time I was just mesmerized by album covers and the pictures on albums. So on the back cover, there was this beautiful, striking portrait of Paul with a beard in this warm winter coat, and wrapped in the coat was this beautiful baby that of his. And the two of them were looking at the camera in such a clear and present way. And I knew that Paul's wife, Linda, was a photographer, and she had taken the picture. And at that moment, I was drawn into the picture, and I felt like I wanted to be there with them. And then you flash forward to 1991, and there I am driving up to George Lucas's Skywalker Ranch in Northern California to spend 3 days with Paul while he's shooting this off the ground video, and I'm there to photograph him throughout. And that served as a real strong reminder to me that the seed was planted at that time when I was 14, and that something was stirring within me And I didn't realize it at the time, but looking back now, I can see that I was being inspired by not only the photographs, but looking at these pictures and portraits that had a certain presence about them. And without realizing it at the time, it was planting that seed, and I later grew into recognizing that that was part of my mission and my purpose, was to be with people in such a way where I could cultivate a layer of presence and trust to bring out the depth of who they are and their authenticity.
Well, having been photographed by you, which are my favorite photographs I've ever owned, and I know that a lot of the people we hang out with who are well known and the same thing, what captures their who they are as people, you have that magic touch. But I don't want you to get away from the story that quickly, because I know that there was another part to the story when you went to the house and you had the tour, I believe. Wasn't there something happened there with the person that gave you the tour?
yes. Thank you. So when I arrive at the ranch, this young woman, attractive young woman, opens the door of the studio, introduces herself as Mary, and she starts giving me a tour of the studio. And then she says, well, let me introduce you to my parents. And as we're walking over to the trailer, I started piecing these bits of the puzzle together. And I remembered, yeah, that's right. Paul and Linda's daughter, his name is Mary. And she was the baby that was on the cover with Paul. So everything was connecting in that moment. And then she opens the trailer door and there are Paul and Linda. And it really felt in that moment like this dream of mine had come true, because clearly spending time with Paul McCartney and then later that year with George Harrison in a different setting were two of my greatest inspirations, and they both happened within a year's time.
So what's it like, I mean, when a guy sort of, you know, meets his idol, or you know, obviously in that moment at 14 when you're looking at that album cover, and I can see that picture so clearly emblazoned in my mind. You know, it's one of those pictures that that stays kind of, I don't know if it's for everyone, but it's certainly one of those pictures. There was something about that picture that I remember all the details of it, and how the baby snuggled in his arm, right? I suppose there's two parts to this question. Is what's it like to kind of suddenly be in front of someone who you have that much reverence for, and how do you go about your job of bringing out their essence and overcoming your own kind of, oh my God, here I am with Paul, you know, does that happen? Or is it like, have you just done so much of it and been around so many great people that it just doesn't come up anymore?
Well, yeah, that's a great question, David, because I'll give that example. So I suppose I was preparing for quite a while in preparing as far as psyching myself up for how do you just stay present in the moment when you're with someone that's had such a strong impact on your life and that has made, you know, such great contributions to my life. So it's a good question that you're asking, because that is pretty much what I work with people on when I'm with people and photographing them. So you're asking that of me as the photographer. And in this case with Paul, it really came down to continually choosing to anchor in just seeing him as a beautiful individual, as I see anybody as a beautiful individual, and not discounting the appreciation that I have for him in the least bit, but continually just coming back to having gratitude for who he is, and remembering that truly we are all equal and that we're all one. And this person just happens to have had a great, tremendous impact on my life. So I can be in gratitude to them, but not look up to them in a way to see that they are any different than I am, if that makes sense.
I imagine, like, having watched you work though, and being sort of in your essence. I know I'm going to ask you some questions around that, because that's what I feel about you, this word essence, is that you unlocked in me, I'll talk personally. I know that you've photographed a lot of my friends that I've introduced you to, and these people, you know, when I look at the photographs you've done, you've really captured who I, what I love about them. And I've never seen that before. I mean, there's so many, these people are photographed so much. They're so well known and they have such a following. And yeah, I've seen hundreds of photographs of them, which I just didn't like. And I've always felt like just didn't, it wasn't able to do the job. But you are able to sort of, you know, in moments, in when you enter into your space, you have this ability. It's almost like a childlike ability, I think. And I, there's an innocence about it, or a purity, maybe. I'm digging for words in my head here because it's hard to describe. But this essence that you portray, that for me was immediately like I'd known you my whole life. And through the process, what sort of unlocking those sort of barriers and guards, I don't know what they are. And not that I have a lot of them, but a lot of people do. A lot of people I work with are sort of, they're hiding out, you know, behind portraits of themselves they think the world want to see. But you seem to unlock that magic, that spark, that thing. Can you talk about that? How you do that, and how did you learn to do that? And was it always easy? Was it immediate, or was there something that happened to you that created that ability? Or
it's a great question. I'd love to talk about that. So when I started taking people's portraits, it certainly wasn't like that for me. I'm sure that I was somewhat concerned and self-conscious about whether I was doing things right, or whether I was, you know, showing up with people in a way that would get them to open up. In fact, I remember times early on when people would say to me, well, just make me smile, you know, tell a joke. And it didn't take me long to recognize, well, first off, that was a lot of pressure. And I'm not a good joke teller per se. So finally I realized, okay, joke telling, remembering jokes isn't my forte. So I need to be the light, basically. I need to be the openness and the expression and the humor myself. So when I'm with people, and this has developed over time, as I'm with people, it gives me the permission, so to speak, to fully express the fullness of who I am, to fully be present, to fully show up, to fully be in a trusting place and honoring, a self-honoring place and an honoring place of whoever's in front of me. So when I'm photographing people, sometimes I'll be very silly, like a child, you were saying. You're very childlike. I can be very silly. I relate to Robin Williams in that way, you know, where he just goes off the wall. And he's an example of, say, a comedian that gave himself permission to just be crazy and have it be okay. So I take not that kind of freneticness, but that joyfulness, that playfulness, and I take that into a session. And that, so I find that joy, being joyful, being playful, being silly, is a wonderful tool and conduit for allowing people to let go and to feel safe and to feel comfortable. Sometimes if that's over the top for some people, then I'll sink down into a more quiet, sort of honoring, still place with people, sometimes more meditative, sometimes focusing on the breath. I found over the years that it really has to do with listening, inner listening, and listening to others when they're with me, as far as what their needs are and what really cultivates for them an environment of feeling safe, of feeling trusting, of feeling like they can just let it all down, as you're saying, letting their guard down, and fully open up and be who they really are, rather than this image that perhaps they thought that they need to be. And I really believe that when we do that, when we just fully let our guard down and let the true essential self, the capital S self of who we are, come through, then that is what allows our pure, authentic beauty to shine, and our pure message of what we're here to give, to fully be present and just expand through the pictures, through the eyes, through the natural smile, through the let go, through this energy that can feel so tangible, just like that picture that we're talking about with with Paul and his daughter.
I know I'm going to talk. I feel so many questions bubbling up inside me as you're sharing this, because obviously, you know, part of the work that I'm most fascinated with is this kind of this search for authenticity, this search for truth. And I always think that truth, and you talk about the word safety. Yes. And I know that there's a part of your philosophy is about experiencing perfection in the moment. Sort of the grace that resides at the core of our being. You know, I know you have so many beautiful ways of expressing this light, but I just want to ask more of a technical question before we go into the stories of that light, which I'm really fascinated by.
Sure.
Technically, you know, I'm still kind of trapped in my question of what, why does some photographs resonate and are, you know, they're just lifelong, like that photograph of Paul McCartney with his daughter, that moment that was captured was so powerful that most people who've seen it once remember it with clarity. And I was thinking about, you know, the cover of Time magazine, the girl from Hiroshima, you know, that same image, which of course is horrific, has a similar kind of longevity where I can see each nuance of that picture. And I know that you've done pictures for Rolling Stone and for Time magazine, and you've had your work published in some of the great places in the world. But what is it about a photograph that is memorable? I mean, there's two essences there. I've used one of shock, obviously, of a horror moment, and then there's the one of beauty and perfection that you talk about. Can you describe why they sit so long in someone's consciousness? What is it, the same thing? Is it just that perfect moment captured? Or,
well, what I see, I love this question. What I see is that both of those images are capturing moments of truth, deep moments of truth. And one is a truth of love and connection, and one is a truth of basically hatred and horror and separation. So, but they're great examples to play off of each other, because both of them are reflecting. In fact, I prefer the word reflecting rather than capture, because I just think it's a more pleasant word.
Yeah.
Capture I associate with grabbing something and holding on to it and hoarding it, and reflecting it seems more honest, where it's really just mirroring and reflecting back. So that is one of the key reasons why I am always inspired by this medium of still photography, because every moment, you know, every moment is that opportunity to reflect back what is real, you know, what's the honesty and the essential presence of that moment. And it's always going to do that. So let's take it back for a moment to photographing somebody. And in one moment, you might click the camera, gets to the click, you might click the camera and you are seeing them being self-conscious. And how does that show up? Well, it shows up through maybe a tightness in the muscles of their face, or in their eyes looking kind of glazed. In the next moment, there might be the let go, you know, the opening to the presence, opening to feeling safe, as we were talking about, opening to feeling trusting. And then all of a sudden, that next frame of the click, the eyes are relaxed. You see a presence. You can feel their soul. You see a natural let go of the muscles in their face. Their mouth is relaxed. They look absolutely open and with you and inviting. So every moment's going to be real. It's just a matter of what is it that you are seeing in each moment. So what what I feel drawn to with this work is to cultivate, whether it's with people or in nature, with animals, what have you, I feel drawn and called to continue to cultivate the love and the beauty and the oneness and the connection. So I do that I don't see that it's any different with doing it in nature or doing it wildlife or doing it with people, because we're all interconnected in that way.
So I have a question though about that, because obviously with people I understand, your gift, because I've been on the other end of your camera and I've watched and felt and experienced and been immersed in the beauty that you give off. I mean, it's a full body experience. We're not talking about getting your photo taken. We're talking about, and in minutes of walking into your space, there's this ease that you're able to conjure up. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit more, because I know that for my work, again, this is something that I'm always striving for people to experience I don't carry a camera, but you know, there's that moment of truth and beauty that exists once we surrender, I think, to who we are. In, you know, and again, I you articulate it so beautifully, I'm not going to even attempt to go there, but this idea, though, that of photographing nature, how do we relate that same essence of, is it more spending time in nature until you feel it before you photograph it? I mean, how come someone like yourself can capture a picture of nature that has that, you know, that resonating effect on memory again, and somebody else goes out there, could stand in the same spot and click the same camera and maybe not capture. What is that? How do you do that with nature? How do you find truth and beauty and essence? And is it who we are then reflecting through the camera?
I think it's partially that. And a large part of it, I believe, has to do with slowing down. When I teach this photography class that I do usually once a year called Revealing the Sacred, the reason I love to teach it is because I love being with people and working with people in a way to help to slow them down, slowing everything down so that we can begin to open up and become more sensitive to seeing and revealing the light that's ever present. That is who we are, that is showing itself through nature, through people in such brilliant ways. So to more accurately answer your question, so if I'm in nature and I am wanting to take a shot that really stands out to me, that really speaks to me, I'm not going to take it until the light is reflecting in a way that gives a certain level of brilliance. So it's a great parallel, David, because you look at that and parallel that to people. It's the same thing. I'm not going to take a picture until their light, till their inner light is open and reflecting their brilliance. And they really are the same in a certain way. And I've never paralleled it and articulated it in that succinct a way. So it's a great question you're asking.
Well, you know, and I'm fascinated now. I got goosebumps when I always say when I get goosebumps, we're always onto something that's, you know, it's there's something more divine, something bigger happening there, right? This idea then that every moment or every view and every person has it. It's not like, I mean, there may be someone listening to us chat right now who's maybe stuck in a dark place in their life, you know, maybe they're, you know, and it could be just an overwhelming burden of, you know, three jobs and huge debts and, you know, and maybe their kids in jail, you know, or their kids in Afghanistan serving in a war. You know, there's just so many things that cloud the light that is always there. But I, what I'm getting from our conversation, which I truly subscribe to, is this idea that the light is always there, but we do a lot to hide it. Is that what we're sort of uncovering here?
Absolutely. I'm thinking of the metaphor of flying in a plane. I mean, I fly a fair amount, and recently I was flying to Omaha, Nebraska to see my dad, and we're flying above the clouds and it's sunny and brilliant out. And then we go through the clouds and it's turbulent. Then we go beneath the clouds and land and it's a cloudy sort of dismal day. Okay. So parallel that to an individual, just as the examples you were just giving, and someone might be going through some tough times, some emotional times, times of pain, and that can appear and feel like a cloud, an emotional cloud over us, and feel like our light is being dampened. When in truth, when you get above the clouds, the sun, the light is always there. So there's, you know, it's a great parallel, because when I'm with somebody and photographing them, part of the opportunity is to be with them wherever they're at, you know, wherever they're at. And sometimes people are not in the most open spaces. I start off my book, which we'll talk about more in a bit, talking about how most people hate having their picture taken. If you do a little interview with most people, the large percentage of people don't like having their picture taken. And there's a lot of reasons for that, which we can talk about more in a bit. But my point is that when I'm with someone, wherever they're at, I have the opportunity to be with them and cultivate not only a trust, but a reminder that their light is always there, it's always present, and that it's safe to allow it to come out and to bring it out. And that is something that is such an honor, and it is such a gift to be able to do. When I was, years ago, I was working on this project that was so dear to my heart, and it was photographing a variety of couples, loving, devoted couples, very deeply in love, ranging in age from 20s to 80s, young, blossoming love to being together for most of their lives. And the photographs are very intimate pictures of them. I'd spend a day with them, and I was documenting, revealing their love and their connection. And from that experience, because it lasted over a few years of working on it, it gave me such a greater anchoring and honor for how to be with people in the most sacred of ways. And you were giving me a beautiful acknowledgement earlier about that, about in the first few minutes of meeting me. So these experiences throughout my adult life, I've had a number of them, have really helped me to cultivate this level of honoring of others and just promote the most sacred of spaces, whether it's talked about or not. For people that don't speak that language, I'm not going to talk that language. I'll just show up and be loving and be caring and be present and be joyful. For those that do speak that language and that orientation, then I might offer doing something together, like a guided meditation or some kind of blessing in bringing in and knowing the truth of the space and what we're creating here. So it's there's so many different aspects to it.
Well, there's something you said, though, which I love. I mean, because I know that you're a spiritual counselor as well in your work. But you said something which is such a an enlightened view of the world, of how you can enter into someone's world and meet them where they're at with the language they speak. And of course, the language you're talking about, for someone who hasn't twigged yet, you know, this idea of, you know, a spiritual being able to, and some people could call it woo-woo. Everyone has a different way of describing it, but this deep spiritual conversation that some people can enjoy and understand each other. You're right. Saying that you go to someone who doesn't speak that language, and you'll use a different mechanism to unlock that moment of brilliance in them, that moment of truth and honesty, that moment of the sacred, right? So that's interesting, though, that ability to walk in. And I think there's a real metaphor here for living every day. And when we're talking about, if we take the camera away now, and mm-hmm. we ask you, you know, what you've learned, because I watch you. And we've had the pleasure of hanging out a bit and dancing together and playing together. And we were on the same team doing Beach Olympics, which we had so much fun and laughter. So we've watched each other a lot around people in all types of situations. And truly what you're talking about is something you're doing in every moment of every, I mean, I've seen you, with Cynthia, your beautiful wife, and how you treat her, how you look at her. You know, it's that, it almost feels like you've got to a place in your life where this moment of light is present a lot. I'm sure you have some bumpy rides through the clouds as well, as we use the airplane metaphor. Yes. But do you feel then, if we talking around this, that there is a practice here of connection with other people that's available to everyone using some of this, some of what we're talking about. It's not just to capture a moment, but to capture a conversation, to capture a friend, that this ability to step in and speak the same language and look for that brilliance light and, you know, and communicate from that, that well of understanding and curiosity and fascination and childlikeness. This is a, this is really about bringing people together, right?
Absolutely, David. And it's a perfect segue for actually talking about my book, which is called Click, Choosing Love One Frame at a Time. And it's due out soon. And
coming soon to a bookstore near you. Ding!
Let's see, where do I want to begin with this? Because it's so much a part of what you're bringing up right now.
Sorry, did I distract you?
No.
I had a squirrel moment.
Humor to it, which is great. So a friend of mine about 2.5 years ago from New York said, Carl, you need to write a book. I said, tell me more. He said, yeah, you got to write a book about, you know, what you know. So I'm walking the dogs that morning and I'm thinking, well, what would I want to write about? And this title came to me in bold letters and I started laughing when I heard it. And the title, which isn't the title of the book, but it's one of the opening lines of the book. And in bold letters, exclamation point, it says, I love having my picture taken. And I started laughing. I'm in the middle of walking and I'm laughing because I'm thinking that's so untrue for most people. So that gave me a good reference point, a good starting point for where I wanted to start writing this book. And I came to recognize, the more I thought about it, as I was saying earlier, that most people dread having their picture taken. It's one of the first things that people say to me when they approach me and are, we're about to start a session is, I just want you to know I don't take a good picture, or I just want you to know I'm very uncomfortable in front of a camera. They have all these mindsets of what they're sure about. So the book started from examining that, and then it goes into the depths of everything that we're talking about, and using the click of the camera as a metaphor for every moment's choice point in our lives, on whether we're going to show up in each moment, just as we've been talking, and be resting in the authenticity of who we really are, of what our authentic and true message is to the world, or whether we're going to be caught up in some level of fear, distraction, or separation. And that's where the book starts off. And then to further answer what you were just addressing, what the book is, the larger scope of the book is about, is taking that metaphor of each moment and how do we apply every moment of our lives as being that choice point in the same way as, where's our attention? Is our attention on just letting the out-breath fully let go and expand and be present in the moment and be honoring of ourselves and honoring of others and being in the trust? Or are we caught up in some level of fear? So I see that it's a great example and a great metaphor of that click being the essential choice point moment. And truly, I do see that every moment of our lives really is that choice. It's that, and whether or not we are aware and awake enough to make a conscious choice in each moment is really the question. So years ago, I was in this wonderful spiritual psychology master's program at the University of Santa Monica. And it was a 2-year, very devoted program to going deep into one's self, capital S, and uncovering, you know, basically uncovering old patterns and beliefs that no longer support us, that we wish to release, letting go, recognizing and letting go of fears, learning a tremendous amount of counseling skills for being able to use on ourselves and with others to be able to show up and be fully present with others, whether or not we are a quote counselor or just being authentic and show how do we show up to be with our loved ones? How do we show up to be with our family? How do we show up to be with our coworkers and be completely authentic, transparent, real, staying true to what our values are? All of that. I mean, all of that was deeply addressed in this two-year intensive program. And without a doubt, that experience in those 2 years anchored in me a much greater awareness and trust and ability to show up in the way that we are talking about and then be that example while I'm photographing and as much as possible as I can while I'm with others in the world.
I often talk about this idea where either affecting or infecting people, you know, that our energy has the ability to bring people down or lift them up. So you'd be aware of it. And I want to ask that question because, you know, obviously, you know, you must have bad days or bad moments or times where you can lose it, or, you know, that there's times where you're in the clouds yourself.
Yes.
And how do you steer back knowing what you know? And what mechanisms have you learned through this process and through your work? And knowing that that brilliance is always there. I mean, you've captured it with with such a variety and range of not just people, but animals and nature. So you're aware more than most of this brilliant light that shines continuously above the clouds of every human being and every landscape and every animal on Earth. How do you get back there when you're in the clouds or you're in the turbulence and you're, you know, and your plane's landed and it's raining like cats and dogs and there's lightning storms? I mean, every human being has those times. How do you get back up through the clouds? What have you learned to do?
Well, I'm experiencing it right now. I don't mean this moment, but at this time in my life, my father's not well. And I've been traveling a lot to go back and see him, and along with my sister. And there are moments that my heart just feels broken, you know, just in pieces, watching him struggling in the way that he is with his health and wanting to be healthy and having pride. And so I'm in one of those time periods right now. And so it's a great it's a great question to answer while I'm in the midst of it. And I can tell you that there are times when I feel paralyzed, you know, where I just feel like it's hard to even get up because I'm feeling such compassion for him. And I've learned with most people, I've really learned how to be empathetic rather than sympathetic. And I think for me, the distinction is empathy being able to really feel for somebody's experience and their pain and not take it on. And sympathy, I think, sometimes can have the involvement of taking on someone else's pain. And I don't do that very often these days, but this is one of those examples where it's hard not to take it on in a deep way because we're so deeply connected. And same was true when my mom was passing close to 30 years ago. So I'm in that period now. And for me, it has to do with not denying how I'm feeling. And I think that's true in any situation, because if we deny it, then we're putting a mask on, it's putting it under the rug, and then it's just going to show up again very soon in some form or another. So how to be authentic and true to how I'm feeling and give myself times to just lay down and do nothing for 15, 20 minutes, sometimes even a good portion of a day, because that's what I'm needing to do, just to process, just to feel the feelings. And while that's going on, simultaneously, I'm also staying true to devotional practices such as meditation, such as reaching out to people that I trust and that are loved ones for support, for reminders of what the truth is. So, you know, it's, for me, it has to do with being true to how I'm feeling and then asking for the support and finding the strength to get up and do things that I know will support me, even though emotionally and physically at that moment, I might not feel like I want to do it. That makes sense?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was making notes as you were speaking, just because I think this idea of empathy versus sympathy. But then you led into this wonderful thing, which I'm all about. My 8 most favorite words that I teach a lot is tell the truth all the time with compassion. Because yes. I realized that once I got in touch with my authentic self and I really practice, I believe, you know, in the way I walk through my life is really showing up without, I always say, ask me anything. There's not a question I want to answer honestly, because, you know, because I train so many trainers, this idea of truth, and you use the word truth maybe 11 times in your answer for about this, you know, while you're going through these clouds, you know, and the idea that, you know, being truthful about how you feel, which again, I think maybe is something that a lot of people are so afraid. And I certainly was. I mean, I was a prover my whole life. You know, I lived a lie for so many years because I was so afraid of the truth. I thought if people heard the truth, then somehow it was going to distance me or they wouldn't like me anymore. And this is when I was younger, especially. And I found the opposite to be true. So, you know, this whole conversation feels like the essence of what you would call luminescence, which I'm going to ask you to just describe in detail. I know you've captured this. You haven't captured it. I'm sorry. You reflect this word. You reflect this word in your, and it's a word that you've kind of made up.
Yes.
Luminescence. But maybe at the heart of luminescence is this yearning for truth. Is that, would you say that could be based on what I'm hearing right now today?
Absolutely. And the word luminescence, obviously there is a word luminescence, but this particular languaging of it is lumen, L-U-M-I-N, and then essence as in our essence, E-S-S-E-N-C-E. So it's the light within our essence, the light of who we are, and I'm still continuing to refine a method, the luminescence method. I'm continuing to open and refine it. It's everything that we're talking about, and I'll start with. This seems like a great interview of metaphors. I see that. I see that beauty has various layers, okay? So a couple years ago, I was in Paris teaching this Revealing the Sacred class, a short version of it, like a 3-hour version. And a group of students and myself are standing in front of this fountain and long rectangular pond at Luxembourg Gardens. And we're looking into the pond, and above the pond is this canopy of trees. So when you look down onto the pond, you're seeing this still reflection. And on the surface, there happened to be a feather floating. So I was pointing out to people, okay, so first let's look at the top layer. And the top layer is you're seeing this feather that's floating on the water. Then you look another layer down, and then you see the water, okay? Then you look another layer down, and you see the reflection of the canopy of trees that are there reflecting from above. So there's 3 layers that you're looking at there. And so I like to compare that to beauty. So if we look at, say, traditional beauty in our society, say a model, you know, or advertising beauty. Quite often, I just call that more of a traditional type of institutional beauty. And what you'll see is pretty faces, pretty features, beautiful makeup, hair, often a lot of retouching, posing being just right, everything looking aesthetically beautiful in this very kind of traditional institutional beauty, which a lot of people are very influenced by. I mean, especially young women are so influenced by that level of surface beauty. Okay, then you go one layer deeper, and you see that the essence coming through maybe of the person, which we were talking about earlier, maybe a presence in the person's eyes and the relaxing of the facial muscles, a natural warm smile might be coming through. So you're beginning to see their essence, and that's the next layer. Then the layer even underneath that, the deeper layer, would be their inner light radiating, fully aglow, absolutely shining through. And you know, just so, and when that is taking place, when you get to that layer, that level of opening of that inner light shining, then making you're making a deep and unspoken connection with the viewer. And the light, it's as if light is recognizing light. And that is the ultimate expression, the ultimate way of being that I cultivate with people to bring it down to that layer. And the luminescence method is a series, it can be a series of different techniques, and sometimes it can be involved with breathing, sometimes it can be involved with doing a guided sort of imagery meditation. Sometimes it can involve being in nature and just slowing down, as I was talking about before, and seeing and feeling the light outside and then within. There's all these different ways that I bring in this level of opening to the inner light. And I'm not sure if that fully answered your question.
Yeah, I think it does. I have a question. I mean, normally I'd be sort of wrapping up around now, but I'm so fascinated by this subject. I want to keep going. But the idea of how does someone, you talk about women, and we know 80% of my students are women, and this idea of self-love, self-discovery, and women feeling invisible, and, you know, that they're not being seen at all. You know, they feel unseen, unheard. How would somebody discover those layers in themselves? How do they look into the mirror and see past what the world expects of them through magazines and sort of the model kind of perfection, and start getting into that second layer of presence, and then that third layer of that when the light is radiating? I mean, can we do that when we're on our own in the bathroom in the mornings and just through our general day, even though, you know, beauty is such a used force today, even to sell. I mean, they can sell anything with a naked body strapped to it, right?
Yeah, well, it's such a, I think it's just such a deep conditioned, I'm looking for the right word, it's not coming to me right now, but dysfunction in our culture of, you know, looking outside of ourselves for the answers. There's a whole chapter in my book that's called Wild Goose Chase that really talks all about that. And, you know, with the game, a wild goose chase, you know, you're chasing something around and you're looking, it's like we're looking outside of ourselves for something that we're never going to find, because it's never outside of ourselves, it's within ourselves. So anytime that, in this case, we're using the example of being influenced by the institutional beauty, in advertising, say, and it's so prevalent, you know, in our culture with kids growing up with it, and especially girls and young women. So it's a great question, you know, how does one be able to experience their own beauty that's not distinguished or determined by how they think they should look by looking at these perfect pictures of models? You know, how does one do that? Well, the book talks all about that, and I'll talk about it a little bit. You know, that I believe that it all comes down to everything that we are really weaving around here, which is how do we deepen in our ability to slow down and to love ourselves fully? And that's why the subtitle of the book is Choosing Love, One Frame at a Time. How do we choose love in each moment of our lives? And I do believe it's not necessarily simple, but it's simple to, it comes down to that simple fact. How do we choose love for ourselves in every moment? And that is something that, you know, it's an ongoing inquiry, and everybody has their own path and their own way of discovering that. But first, it's got to come with the willingness. It's got to come with young people, with having role models. We certainly know how important it is to have role models that are reflecting back values and loving, seeing people that are successful, that have the values that are about honoring themselves and honoring others and honoring the planet, being conscious in that way, and then being able to take those role models and learn from them. I think that's a huge component for young people. I'll bet that you've experienced that. I certainly did when I was growing up. I mean, that's why I was so eager and drawn to photographing Paul McCartney and then later George Harrison, because the Beatles, for me, served as tremendous role models when I was a kid and then in my teens. And at least I used them, not only their music, but what I felt that they represented, which was opening to higher consciousness, opening to loving ourselves, opening to how do I show up and be the love in the world in order to have a world that works for everybody. You know, so having those role models for a child and for a teen, I think, is one of the key components. And, you know, I believe that that's part of what your mission is, it's part of what my mission is, it's part of what a lot of the people that we know that their mission is serving as reflections of that, as examples of that for not only young people, but for anyone that feels like they are questioning and in the clouds and not knowing how to access getting out of their funk, how to access opening to their inner beauty and their inner light. So circling around in a large way.
No, what's beautiful is that we've come back to Paul McCartney again, but this idea that each one of us have the responsibility to be that model for other people, and knowing those of us that are aware, and most people who are listening in for this already have awareness. You know, they don't find this by accident. They're drawn to this kind of podcast series because there is something calling to them that they want to learn from these great minds, you know. But I think this idea that we each have a responsibility to live that light, knowing that it's above the clouds, that even though we're going through the crap and we're going through the turbulence, that there is that light there. I know that, you know, our time's come to an end here, but I really want to bring you back and talk a little bit about the Dalai Lama. He's one of my superheroes. I know you photographed him, and we'll have another chat about that. But I have a final question for you on what is it, the kick-ass life? If I ask you what it's like to live a kick-ass life, if you could describe to me what a kick-ass life is for you, that would be awesome.
Okay. A kick-ass life for me is tapping in every moment to that light, to the presence of what is that inspired truth that is having its way through me, and allowing that to fully be activated in every moment, so that when it is activated, that I am absolutely fearless, that I am absolutely courageous from moment to moment to moment, being open to making the choices that are the highest choices for my greatest gifts to be expressed and revealed, and to be able to receive fully the gifts from others that support my highest vision on the planet.
Wow. I'm going to replay that like 9 times and listen to that. That was awesome. Carl, your website has got so many reflections of your craft and your beauty and what you've captured in others. Can you just give us that website so people can go and check it out?
Sure. It's my name. So it's www.carl, C-A-R-L, Studna, Studna.com.
So www.carl, C-A-R-L, Studna, Studna.com.
No, Studna.
Oh, Studna. See, I left school at 15. I can't spell. All right, Studna. All right, and I'll make sure we talk about that a lot. Carl, what a joy. I'm looking forward to hanging out again soon. You are just an impeccable, beautiful reflection of everything you teach in every heart you touch.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure being with you, and I so look forward to playing again soon.
All right, ciao. So what I tell you, I knew it was going to be great. What an amazing, amazing man. And I feel that it's one of those things where an individual like this comes along and is able to share such wisdom. And I love his metaphors. I mean, we sort of joked about a lot of different metaphors, and I really want to talk to him about his time with the Dalai Lama, because the photographs he took are astounding. This idea of the clouds, you know, when I talked about that, he used the airplane metaphor about flying above the clouds. And of course, I started off the whole story around my flying. This idea about being above the clouds, it's always beautiful up there. And then, you know, sometimes in life we go into the clouds and the darkness and the thunderstorms and the turbulence and this idea that down below, you know, you can get into this sort of crappy weather and raining and snowing or whatever. And knowing that that light's always there, is that there's a way out. And, you know, the fact that he was going through it right now is just so beautiful, that he's going through that and understands it's there. And that whole idea of truth, it's seeking truth, is that first, his first thing is to be aware of his feelings and giving himself time to feel it, to lay on the couch sometimes for an hour, 15 minutes or a whole day, and then sort of reaching out and asking for help. So hope you enjoyed it. I certainly did. And it's great to be here again. I'm so looking forward. I just get how many people are out there that we can find that we want to chat to, that we want to bring to the Kick-Ass Life podcast. Don't forget, you can go to the website, kickasslife.com. And don't forget, when you're on iTunes, you got to subscribe to the channel, and these things will come to you. And if you want to give us a review, that helps, and give us a rating. Let's see if we can hit 5 stars for you. Ciao, babies.
That was kick-ass.